submerge, no choice. A never has just given. All day, all year, too close, too near. I never wanted to listen. I don't look for congratulations or to hear the crowd applaud. It's just this reckless mind wasting time. Lost every time that I fought. With a mind full of madness and a heart full of sadness, I'll go wherever you lead. With a head full of misses, all I've never finished, the person I'll never be. Oh, 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 oh. No rhymes, no sense. All waves, no clear blue ocean. Just stones and clines, way harder this mind. Pushing on doors that won't open. I'll turn down any meditation. I'll breathe until the air ran out. It's just this mixed up mind wasting time. Putting my decisions in doubt. With a mind full of madness and a heart full of sadness, I'll go wherever you lead. With a head full of misses, all I've never finished, the person I'll never be. With a mind full of madness and a heart full of sadness, I'll go. Just this reckless mind wasting time. Lost every time that I fought.
And welcome, welcome, welcome. Good morning, good morning, good morning, dear listeners. Obviously, as we just heard the sounds there of the group, Take That. And before that, it was sort of like Eternal Band by the name of Eagles with the song One of These Nights. And obviously, it was slightly in remembrance of the previous day, which obviously most of us men probably would have forgotten, that being Valentine's Day. Don't worry, guys. I was also in your neighborhood of forgetting that it was Valentine's Day. And yeah, primarily for those of you that did remember, good luck and all the best. And obviously, congratulations for doing so and all that other particular, affiliated well-wishing in that regard. But for what we always do here on Sunday morning sessions from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m., we obviously explore the various and interesting developments and discussions that would has happened in history or that have played a particular part in terms of the course of human history across the world and their contributions to the current, you know, situation of the current world that we know it as we know it to currently be. And since it is sort of like in remembrance of Valentine's Day, I'd like to bring in a particularly, you know, interesting talking point for this morning's session. Now, it has to do, or it actually sort of like follows on the Friday the 13th, 13th of February's particular remembrance of World Radio Day that obviously took place on Friday. And just on the heels of it also, the particular, not, it is internationally known, but it was more, it is more tied to the relationship between, well, the United Kingdom primarily and Iran for, on this particular, significant talking point. Now, our discussion focuses primarily on the, you know, the aftermath, or not the aftermath, because the author by the name of Salman Rushdie is still, you know, he's still alive and he's obviously still, you know, very well. Obviously just in a more protected sphere because he lives in the UK. Even though recently he was attacked, not recently like this year, a couple of years back after COVID. And it, primarily is that, if you don't know who Salman Rushdie is, he wrote a book, he's an author, just so that you know, but he wrote a book in the 80s, known as The Satanic Verses. And don't worry, guys, it has got nothing to do with Christianity, you know, in that regard. However, it is a fictional book. It has got nothing to do with religion even. However, an interesting thing happened on 14 February 1989, you know, almost 37 years that direction, is that the religious leader of Iran, Khomeini, declared a fatwa on Salman Rushdie in terms of that whoever from the, you know, from the Muslim religion across the world has the right to kill or assassinate Salman Rushdie wherever they find him. And they placed a bounty on his, you know, on his head. So in that particular regard, it made things peculiar for Salman Rushdie. Now, we will be looking into specifically the, you know, what was literally, you know, what is in the book, because as I said, the book does have a very provocative name. It is also primarily one of those books that had a lot of scrutiny applied to it. But for one author to, well, literally, unfortunately, be considered to be hounded by a whole religion and a good part of the world that, you know, from which the religion also hails from, so it's a whole bunch of countries, made things very difficult for Rushdie, because Rushdie, who himself is of Pakistani heritage, but he's, you know, he grew up and lived in the United Kingdom for most of his life, primarily, you know, has got it difficult, even till today. I mean, he is someone that is sort of like in his, I think in his 70s already, and the important thing is, yeah, he's in his 70s, he's 78 already. And obviously, he's been knighted already. Well, they say here he's of Indian heritage on his particular sort of explainer. He's even been knighted already by the British monarchy. However, just to share a particularly interesting talking point from here, the recent attack that Salman Rushdie experienced was something that you know, okay, it happened in 2022, obviously. And what unfortunately happened was that this particular attack on him took place in the United States, not even in the UK, where he has been living for most of his life. Now, this has obviously led that to him, unfortunately losing the ability of one of his eyes, his right eye, for that matter, was that the gentleman, who obviously committed that particular act against Rushdie was, you know, given a 25-year sentence because he was attacked in the United States. And, this is still as the fatwa, that particular bounty is still active on Rushdie. And it was also, you know, was a particular significant event. Now, the sentencing of the individual that did the attack, his name is Hadi Matar, happened only in 2025 last year. So the sentencing is done, even though the attack took place in 2022, 3 years after that, the sentencing only then concluded. But it helps us to understand specifically for this particular morning how one man, just with one fictional book he wrote, okay, the book is not fictional, but the book comes from the fictional genre because it explores, because he's a novelist, you know, it explores, you know, a fictional perspective or a fictional scenario. Which actually also then makes things troubling primarily because this has not been the first time in human history where religion has had an issue specifically with freedom of expression. Now, freedom of expression in this regard is literally, even if you look at it currently, in the space of post-COVID, meaning post 2020, heading into this particular direction of on your way to 2030, is that there's been a lot of troubling scenarios wherein freedom of expression has been challenged. Or specifically that, and in many cases and in many rights, not to discredit the professionals from my profession, that being the journalists specifically, that freedom of expression, that they are the only people that can express themselves or have sort of like carte blanche to freedom of expression, because in many scenarios it wasn't always the information sharing space, but rather the artists who had pushed the boundaries of freedom of expression. Back in some of the particular talking points of my Sunday morning take in last year, in 2025, and the previous year of 2024, I did a few of the discussions around the banned books in history or books that have been banned in history and what that list included. And in many cases, it really pushed the boundaries regarding the certain kinds of concepts and subject matter that were explored or contained by the authors in their work. Now, these are writers. Some of them did have journalistic roots. For example, Ernest Hemingway. There was also, what was the guy's name, from that Johnny Depp loved playing, because he made two movies of the guy, of playing this particular author's characters, Hunter S. Thompson. Johnny Depp loved the, you know, playing as Hunt, as the characters that Hunter S. Thompson had, you know, developed for his books. The one is obviously where he met his last wife, Amber Heard, in Cuba, which actually was a discussion that Hunter S. Thompson positioned his character literally months or a year and a half before the Cuban Revolution took place, i.e. before Fidel and, you know, Ernesto Che Guevara, you know, did their thing in terms of liberating, you know, Cuba, specifically from the economic clutches that the United States had over Cuba. Obviously that has led to the current situation as we know Cuba to be. And he also played, Johnny Depp obviously played the other particular character, which was a journalistic character in the movie that I enjoyed greatly, known as Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. primarily in of a journalist who is, you know, who has to go and cover certain beats and certain events. And then he and his, you know, his lawyer literally go on these sort of like narcotic induced, partying escapades in Las Vegas. And every time it is Las Vegas, the two of them are doing these particular antics. Now, I'm describing to you movies based upon the books. And the books, obviously, they weren't pushing the boundaries. However, they were incorporating various significant events woven into the story that has to be told, and thus displaying to the reader and the viewer of the movies, you know, what the imagination of this author or the storyteller is, you know, what are the limitations of this storytelling that is taking place. The important thing that you've got to look into this, dear listeners, has been that this has happened continuously in human history. Now, I am going to get quickly into the introductory aspect of, you know, what happened on 14 February 1989, specifically with how the fatwa came to be. But just in this last particular sighting has been that there's a reason also why we had the Renaissance period occur. Because when Christianity, or when it was just one form of Christianity present in Europe, because we all know Christianity comes from Europe, has been a discussion primarily that the freedom of expression was also put to the test. The great minds, for example, like Michelangelo, Donatello, Leonardo da Vinci, and what was the other guy's name? I know it's the four names that the, and Raphael, yes, it's the four names literally, if you guys also did not know, it's literally the four names that the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles also have. They've got the names of these four great Italian Renaissance, you know, inventors, artists, and great minds, in that regard. So, you've got this particular template that helps you understand what was the Renaissance period for Europe. The Renaissance period was a period also wherein creativity was trying to break away from being controlled by religion. You can, yes, and this did happen, dear listeners, in Christianity. You could only do songs, writings, and specific other particular artistic works in honor of the religion. Literally. There were obviously private commissions, for example, or smaller commissions like painting the daughter of, you know, of someone significant in the community, or of doing a sketch rock art or something of a famous figure in the town or of political leadership. But further than that, you know, literally there was confines put on the kinds of expression that were allowed. Music, or which also included music. Now, it brings us from that particular template up to what literally, you know, led to Salman Rushdie still having a fatwa hanging over his head till today. And the man is 78 years old. Now, on 14 February 1989, just to share this with you, dear listeners, the religious leader Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini of Iran issued a fatwa and offered a bounty for the assassination of the author Salman Rushdie, whose novel, The Satanic Verses, Khomeini denounced as blasphemous. There was also a novel written about, literally about, the Salman Rushdie affair, by another author, in terms of obviously observing what was going on. And this book came out literally a year after 1989, actually 2 years, like 1991, thereabout, which also helps to expand specifically, a year later, which also helped to expand literally, you know, what was the whole lowdown regarding the fatwa that was issued on Salman Rushdie. But before we get into what was that particular expansion done by that author of that particular book, We've got to get into understanding the controversy around the book itself, the Satanic Verses book. Now, when you had to look into the book itself, the Satanic Verses controversy, also known as the Rushdie Affair, is, and it still is active, a controversy that was sparked by the 1988 publication of the book Satanic Verses by the Indian-British-American author. Now, Salman Rushdie is predominantly British. I mean, if you hear an interview of the man, he's got a British accent. He has lived extensively in the United Kingdom, and he's obviously been there all his life. The book itself explores a particular pathway of the character. The particular character of the protagonist within the religion of Islam, and it also has an element of, because it's fiction, you know, there's things applied to it, primarily that the plot itself consists of a frame narrative that uses elements of magical realism, which also is, you know, interlaced with a series of subplots that are narrated as dream visions experienced by one of the protagonists. Now, this particular narrative outlined by the book involves Indian expatriates in contemporary England, the two protagonists, which is Gibril Farishta and Saladin Chamcha, are both actors of an Indian Muslim background. Now, Farishta, the other character, is a Bollywood superstar who specializes in playing Hindu deities. And if you don't know the deities in Hinduism, which is the world's oldest religion, primarily is that in Hinduism, they've got many gods, for that matter. They've got one chief god, and then there's many gods. And the character is also partly based on the Indian film stars Amitabh Bachchan and N.T. Rama Rao. Now, Chamcha, the other character, who's an Anglophile immigrant, English-speaking, obviously, immigrant who has cut himself off from his Indian heritage, works as a voiceover artist in England. Now, at the heart of this particular discussion, both of these two characters are trapped in a hijacked plane by Sikh separatists flying from India to Britain. And the separatists land the plane and take many of the passengers hostage for months, but after the negotiations fail, the separatists force the plane to take off and detonate it over the English Channel between the United Kingdom and France. Now, it then obviously takes on further spiritual, the depictions within the storyline after the characters pass away because of the tragic event as outlined, as I just mentioned to you right now. And as you obviously heard right there, the particular narrative or the particular perspective taken by those who probably feel like there was anything wrong specifically with the kinds of depictions that took place, obviously feel that the book is attacking Islam in one or other way. However, at the heart of the book's particular plot is that the two characters actually have a personal, not a vendetta, but they've got a personal grudge with each other. Or one of the characters actually has the grudge. And that this particular grudge is still carried on into the afterlife, specifically, where the obvious, spiritual elements and other stuff are taking place in terms of the plot of the story in the book. Because this is now obviously as the two characters are connected through fate or one other particular sort of magical destiny, and that they are, tied to each other continuously, even into the afterlife, and thus the plot still continues. The story still continues. The story doesn't end with just them passing away in the explosion, which they were hostages of in that scenario. Now, the controversy itself obviously brings back the indication in terms of freedom of expression being threatened by religious fanaticism. Now, the fatwa itself and the controversy itself centers on the novel's references to verses which come from the Quran itself. And these are verses found within the Quran. And it came to include also a larger debate about censorship and religious violence. Now, it also included the numerous, well, negative activities and attempted killings of Rushdie himself. So the numerous killings and attempted killings were also part of this particular affair. And it's not that Rushdie has been, you know, sort of like hurt multiple times, but it's attempted, you know, incidents on his life because he still lives in protected custody. And then there was obviously also bombings by perpetrators who supported Islam. Now, the affair, that's now the Rushdie affair, had a notable impact on the geopolitics when Ruhollah Khomeini, that's now the supreme leader of Iran at the time, issued the fatwa in 1989 that to order all Muslims to kill Rushdie when they come across him. The Iranian government has changed its support specifically for the fatwa several times, including in 1998 when Mohammad Khatami, who was the Iranian politician and a cleric also at the time, who served as the fifth president of Iran from 1997 to 2005, said that the regime no longer supported the fatwa. In 2017, a statement was published on the official website of the current supreme leader, Khamenei, so there was Khomeini, and this is now Khamenei, who stated that the decree is as Imam Khomeini had issued, and in February 2019, it ultimately stated that Khomeini's verdict was solid and irrevocable. So they've, you know, the Iranian government has jumped backwards, forwards, backwards, forwards every time with new leadership. Ultimately, you know, you just have to take it that it's the fatwa is still active. Now, the issue was also said to have divided Muslims from Westerners along the fault line of culture, and to have also put a core Western value of freedom of expression. And primarily, that's also where this particular discussion centers on, because freedom of expression is not just enjoyed by the professionals in my profession, that being journalists and media professionals, but also by authors and still by artists and still by musicians as well, because they were the forebearers and specifically the frontliners who carried the flag of freedom of expression the greatest. Now, it highlighted specifically, as I mentioned, in terms of the difference in opinion by the Western world, and which also includes Africa, and also the Islamic world, which also includes Africa, in terms of what freedom of expression has to look like. And primarily, it cited that no one should be killed or face a serious threat of being killed for what they say or write, against the general view of the Muslim world that non-Muslims should not be free to disparage the honor of the Prophet, or indirectly criticize Islam through satire. And if you don't know about Charlie Hebdo, that's also the same situation that happened. And that religious violence is appropriate in contemporary history in order to defend Islam and Muhammad. Now, that's obviously some of the bigger challenging points that have taken place and still continue to take place. Even though geopolitics is taking a different direction, media or global media would be showing you in a different direction of developments, and other things would be happening on the sides somewhere, and this and another direction somewhere else. Still at the heart of this, you still find these persisting, sort of like opposing fronts regarding freedom of expression. Now, the UK-born, Pakistani writer Hanif Qureshi, called the fatwa one of the most significant events in post-war literary history. Now, before we continue, dear listeners, we're going to be taking a short musical break and be coming back right after that, heading into the rest of our conversation here on your number one talk radio station, that being Eagle FM. And this is my Sunday morning take.
Cosa vuoi? Un gelato a pomodoro, un castello di cacao, Trevignese, caffè 33, Maromba 6.
E poi.
Sì, io Rossi cosa vuoi? Pilotare un autojet, far la doccia di champagne, con un fracco cocco e sbancare il casino.
And as we come back there from the sounds primarily of Till Bronner, who had obviously gave us that particular jazz number there with the name Viva La Felicita. Viva La Felicita. Primarily here on your number one talk radio station. It does get us up about 7 minutes out from the top of the hour at 6 a.m. That would be our midway point. But continuing where we left off primarily here on my Sunday morning take, it is an interesting particular talking point of freedom of expression, ultimately, when you see the sort of like the, you know, when things get as bad as they do, primarily in this particular context. Now, so far in the African context, I have not seen anything on a similar note, even though you have, you know, I don't want to use the phrase top notch, because that's a phrase ultimately that my colleague Helmut and ultimately, you know, former President Mbumba, are famous for, you know, top notch. But if you look at the caliber of authors coming through from South Africa, from Nigeria, from Ghana, the whole of North Africa, the French speaking parts of Africa, which are, you know, predominantly Muslim, the North African French-speaking parts of Africa. It makes things tricky primarily in terms of what freedom of expression also looks like in each one of those particular scenarios. However, on this grander, more global scale, this takes an interesting twist to the impacts that religious leaders can have on freedom of expression. Now, for background discussion, even before the publication of the Satanic Verses happened, The books of Salman Rushdie had also already stoked controversy because he had written other books before 1988 when the Satanic Verses were brought out. And remember, he uses excerpts. The reasons why the book has that name is because he uses excerpts from the Islamic holy book, the Quran. So probably there is an issue with that, just so that you know. But it's not that there's anything, you know, in a different light happening. Rushdie saw his role as a writer, specifically his own particular perspective as a writer, as including the function of antagonist to the state, which is pretty much an open statement, that a very broad statement to make, primarily about how a writer tries to push the limits in their own right. Just so that you know, on this particular part, the guy that wrote the book series that I love, the girl with the dragon tattoo, the girl that played with fire, the girl that kicked the hornet's nest, Stieg Larsson, even though he's deceased, you know, already, because his books were printed posthumously after his passing, by his family, is that Stieg Larsson was actually considered to have written content, you know, that was way too, what's the word that they use? It was way too, you know, too explicit, in its own right. The subject matter specifically contained in these books by Stieg Larsson. And Larsson, had a particular problem because he was always shown away by the publishers until obviously, you know, after his passing. Then the publishers decided to use his work, which sounds very weird because it sounds literally like what happened to Vincent van Gogh, because van Gogh was laughed at. He was ridiculed for the kind of art style that he had in the 1800s. And even after, you know, he cut his own ear specifically to make that famous painting of himself with the bandage around his head, you know, still he was not famous when he was alive. Only when he passed away did the van Gogh sort of like art actually get any form of prominence and any form of sort of like, you know, infamy, because only after the artist passed away. So this makes things also a little bit interesting. Even though Rushdie is still alive, and even though Rushdie is still obviously writing, I had tried reading a Rushdie book. It was not this particular book. It was a different title. It was pretty difficult for me to read. Yes, you do get some books that are just, the first 5 pages just make things difficult for you to read. It's problematic. Don't worry, guys. As a reader, I've been consulted by a fellow reader that unfortunately, if there are books that you find difficult reading for your sanity primarily and for your mental well-being, put that book away and then move on to a different title. Oh, there's only been one book that has done this to me in my entire life so far. And the book just does not resonate with me. I've really tried. The book just really does not resonate with me, and it doesn't give me vibes, of positivity. I don't like using the word vibes, but it just doesn't do that. It's probably because the book was given to me as a gift. Probably. Probably. But yeah. So when you look at the particular controversies that Rushdie himself even had been involved in, had been that his second book, known as Midnight's Children, angered Indira Gandhi. Now, if you don't know who Indira Gandhi was, she was the daughter of Mahatma Gandhi, and she was also president of India. And Rushdie, who had by that time been living in the United Kingdom already, obviously, was, you know, also sort of like angering a whole country of his origin, or his origins, being India, because Midnight's Children seemed to suggest that Mrs. Gandhi, and this is an excerpt also, was responsible for the death of her husband through neglect. Now, in his 1983 Roman Acliffe, Shame, which is another particular book that takes aim on Pakistan itself, the book itself also included, focusing on political characters, culture in Pakistan, and religion as well in Pakistan. And the book also covered a central episode in Pakistan's internal life, which portrays as a family squabble between Iskandar Harappa, which is one particular character, and his successor and executioner Raza Hider, which also obviously makes things very weird. So those are two books already that angered two countries that were already at war with each other during a specific period of the 1980s, India and Pakistan. And then a third book also brought its own particular controversy by Rushdie, The Virgin Iron Pants, which has been identified as various characters in... this was a character in that 1983 book by the name of Roman Acliffe, Shame, that a specific character literally personified one of Pakistan's more famous political leaders. This is Benazir Bhutto. If you did not know who she was, Benazir Bhutto was a prime minister at the time of Pakistan. Now, Benazir Bhutto unfortunately passed away, I think in the 2000s. She was shot and killed at a political rally. At one of her party's political rallies. It was a very famous incident because I actually saw the particular sort of like news briefing that BBC broadcast that particular day. Because I was still a student, you know, and as a student, I was, you know, consuming a lot of current affairs from around the world. And, you know, things at that particular time were turbulent because of the war on terror, and Pakistan still plays a significant role in the war on terror, even though relations between Pakistan and India are pretty low right now because of last year's event, if you guys remember, and the direct bombing that India committed against Pakistan, because, you know, the discussion has been that Pakistan is protecting the attackers that shot and killed the tourists in that specific part of northern Pakistan / northern India, because they ran over the border, which is where it's supposed to be the borderline, and they committed the crime and they ran back over the border into Pakistan. So Rushdie himself obviously has been doing his particular part. I just don't know how people can think that if you see a different character's name in a book, you think that you are the character, which technically speaks of a little bit of someone of, you know, in overinflated egos a little bit, thinking that you literally are. Because if it doesn't name you, it does describe something similar, but it doesn't name you. And unfortunately, I don't see any particular correlation. Another particular scenario has been that also that positions that Rushdie has taken as a committed leftist prior to the publication of his book also helped to sort of like exacerbate relations, specifically to form part of the source of the controversy. Rushdie defended many of those who would later on attack him during the particular controversy. He also forcefully denounced the Iranian Shah's government and supported the Islamic Revolution of Iran. So he was also for it. And that was primarily only in the early days or in the early stages when the Islamic Revolution was taking place in Iran. Now, he also condemned the U.S. bombing raid on Tripoli in 1986, but he found himself threatened by Libya's leader Muammar Gaddafi 3 years later after showing public support. He also wrote A book that was bitterly critical of U.S. foreign policy in general and its war in Nicaragua in particular. And we did that particular discussion of Nicaragua literally on 3 January, start of this year, because it resonated with 3 January of 1990. I don't know why in 2026 events of 1989/1990 are so significant in 2026. Don't ask me, guys. I just researched these particular points and I discovered the correlation taking place. Now, for example, still on the critique that he had on the U.S. foreign policy in Nicaragua, included the calling the United States the bandit posing as a sheriff, which is still something you can still apply till today. I mean, it's been nothing new so far. And after the Ayatollah's fatwa was issued, Rushdie, however, was accused by the Iranian government of being an inferior CIA agent. So it makes things weird. But here's the interesting part specifically that helps us to look at how you can look at the aspect of expression. And when I say the aspect of expression can take many forms. Sometimes expression can be complete silence as well. And one of the weird things has been that some people sometimes try to force you into response. There is no such particular limitation or such particular antic that can, if it goes against your particular will, then it's an unfortunate scenario. But you are under no particular obligations, even in certain circumstances. And I won't say it out loud here because it might sound that I would be sort of like promoting some sort of anti-social behavior. However, people do have the right to stay silent. And people do have the right also to maintain a silence. And under no obligations does it indicate a non-contractual behavior or a contractual behavior in any right. And that's what many people also forget, is that, you know, intimidation and manipulation are part of everyday occurrences and engagements and interactions between humans, everyday peoples, that you can observe, you can see it, you might even be a perpetrator, or you would have been a particular recipient of said particular antics. But it's obviously a human ingrained behavior. Now, expression, dear listeners, should not just be confined to what artists, authors, and journalists and musicians can enjoy. Freedom of expression can also be a government official, from a president to the lowest of low government officials. Can also be, you know, people in service, which would be, you know, emergency services, because expression is an idea of the mind. It's an idea of the mind, hence the reason also why copyright and intellectual property are, you know, very nuanced conversations to have regarding how do you protect an idea of the mind and what are the particular stipulations for protecting an idea of the mind. So, still highlighting certain particular talking points that came through from this controversy of 1989, specifically on 14 February of 1989, had been the controversial elements contained within the book that led to the fatwa. Now, the title of the book immediately sparked protests against the book itself. The title referred obviously to the legend of the religious leader or the religious deity in Islam, Muhammad, where a few verses were supposedly spoken by him as part of the Quran, which praised a pagan goddess, Al-Alat, of Al-Alat, Al-Utsa, and Manat. Now, remember, it's a work of fiction. It's a work of fiction. I'll reiterate this. The interesting thing was obviously also that how these particular phrases were viewed. Now, the verses were then withdrawn on the grounds that specifically the not-so-holy entity that we also have in Christianity had sent them to deceive Muhammad into thinking that they came from God. Now, these particular verses, in inverted commas, are said to have been revealed between verses 20 and 21 in Surah An-Najm of the Quran itself, and also featured in accounts of Al-Tabari and Ibn Ishaq. Now, the verses also appear in other accounts specifically of the religious deity's life, and verse 23 and so on also implied that these verses were fabricated by forefathers of idolaters and the likes. So obviously it brought the whole religion into disrepute, specifically in a work of fiction, in a book that was portraying fiction. Now obviously things did not look so good, because Salman Rushdie writes in English. He doesn't write in any other language. He writes in English. So he's an English, author. And yes, even though his background is from the Indian, from the Indian subcontinent, as it, the term was always used, it's a term that I could never understand coming through from a cricketing terminology, the subcontinent. But technically it's a part of India that you, it's a part of the Asian continent that you can, that has its own particular identity. You can literally cut it out and then it has its own identity, similar to also the identity of Far East Asia, that you can cut out and it has its own identity, and similar to the Middle East that has its own particular identity. And you can see these particular different clusters of the whole Asian continent minus Russia, literally that looks unique in three different variations. Getting back into the controversies, that sparks from the literature itself in contained in the book, was also that there were, the utterances and the withdrawal, obviously, of the so-called verses that formed an important subplot in the novel, which recounts several episodes also in the life of the prophet himself. And the phrase that Arab historians and later on Muslims overall used to describe the incident of the withdrawn verses was not in its in its own right satanic, but that they had a different kind of a appearance to them, these particular verses, and that the phrase itself of the verses was unknown to Muslims. And it was also coined by another particular, a collective of academics who obviously went and studied the reaction by the Muslim world to the book in terms of trying to understand, what's actually at heart here, what's at play, is it really so bad and stuff like that. These were particular questions that these academics obviously were trying to assess. Was a scenario where they were trying to understand, okay, so, what was the severity of what the book obviously portrays in the subplot that is continuing? Now, in the heart of it, the story itself is found, the story itself is not found specifically in various sources, and this is in Sunni or in Shiite sources. And so much also specifically another particular author or another particular academic himself in his own commentary stated that the particular traditions are also undoubtedly a fabrication of heretics and foreign hands and have not been found in any of the authentic books present in the religion, the Islamic religion itself. And according to another historian, academic slash academic, specifically who noted that when attention was drawn to the book with its title, religious sections from the Muslim world found it incredibly sacrilegious and took it to imply that the book's author claimed that verses of the Quran were the work of the devil. And that has been predominantly the narrative that has been driven, the particular perspective that has been motivated, the particular viewpoint that has been used, even for the motivation for the existence of the fatwa. According to another particular sort of like academic, other controversial elements also included the use of the name Mahund. If you did not know what that also meant, was this was a different variant of the name Muhammad. And it's often found in medieval and later on European literature. And the name has been used in the past by Christian writers to vilify the Islamic prophet Muhammad. And this is said to be a derogatory term as well, specifically in honor of the prophet. And it was used by the English during the Crusades. The English, because if you did not know, the British, the English had a crusade. They had the Third Crusade under Richard the Lionheart. The first two crusades were done by the French, with the French supports, you know, supporting nobles, obviously. And this was obviously as they were, you know, doing crusades to Jerusalem, because the goal was Jerusalem. And then there was also another use of the term Jahiliyyah, which denoted the time of ignorance before Islam for the holy city of Mecca. The use of the name Gabriel for a film star, and obviously of the name of Saladin, the well-known Muslim military leader during the Crusades. And this was used for a negative entity in the book. I won't mention the entity. And also the name of Aisha, who was the wife of Muhammad as well, for a fanatical Indian girl who leads her village on a fatal pilgrimage. So obviously, as you can see, the positioning of characters within the plot of the book itself was also problematic. Now, I could understand specifically even why political leaders from both Pakistan and India at the time were unhappy with how Rushdie actually portrayed life in that neighborhood of the world, and ultimately also how Rushdie also spoke to, you know, a part of the world that had not been written much about in the English-speaking world. But it actually brings up interesting talking points and developments. But before we continue, guys, we'll quickly be taking another short musical break. And after the musical break, we'll be coming back and heading into the rest of this morning's programming. You're here on my Sunday Morning Take. This is your Sunday morning session from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. on your number one talk radio station, that being Eagle FM.
Late. Thank you.
coming back there from the sounds of the Empire of the Sun with the song Television. Before that, it was The War on Drugs with the song with the name Change. And ultimately, sort of like bringing us into where we left off on our discussion, being that the plot, the characters, the particular content that was applied within the book had a problematic scenario to a whole part of the world. And being that many of the other particular, you know, there were also other particular issues that also further compounded the relationship. Well, not the relationship, but rather sort of like, okay, I cannot prove that there was a relationship angle, but rather in terms of what people from a Muslim background thought the author thought about their particular religion. Other issues that obviously angered many Muslims or had found, or how many Muslims had found offensive, included Abraham being called a particular negative word for casting, you know, Hagar and Ishmael in the desert, and a character named Salman the Persian who served as one of the prophet's scribes, which an apparent reference to the story was controversial among many Muslims. Because he was also a Meccan convert by the name of Abd Allah ibn Sa'd, who left Islam after the prophet failed to notice small changes he had made in a dictation, specifically in the Quran. Now, this is obviously, as academics had also identified, that other more general issues in the book likely could have also, or were likely to also anger the whole of the Muslim world. Primarily a complaint in the book by one of the character's companions, specifically that, you know, I can't read the particular excerpt from the book, but it highlighted primarily a mix-up of Islamic law with other particular elements, and also that highlighted various particular plays. Now, I have to bring in a conversation point right here at this particular junction, so that you also know that there are nuances taking place or that exist out there. Now, there's a nuance. There's a particular point of division between the Saudis, who have the holy site of Mecca in their neighborhood, in their country, and the Iranians, even though it seemed like, and China got this right, remember, back in 2023 or 2024, China got the two countries of Iran and Saudi Arabia to literally shake hands and, in a very public manner, sort of like say, yes, we can live in harmony. The nuanced difference or discussion that obviously was at play just before the ad break pops up was a direction in terms of which the religion of Islam takes. Now, if you don't know, and if you did not know, there are Shiite Muslims and there are Sunni Muslims. But before we come back.
Choose driving sober over driving intoxicated. Choose to obey speed limits over speeding. Choose to use pedestrian crossings over crossing just anyway. And choose to replace worn-out tires over pinching pennies. Choose to do the right thing on our roads and save lives.
This message was brought to you by the National Road Safety Council.
We come back from the quick break right there, and just where I left off primarily was highlighting to you that there are literally nuances and that there are literally also religious differences, even though both sides of the same coin of the religion, you know, basically try to adhere to the same discussion. The important thing is that there's obviously, and then the nuances that exist within the Muslim religion, specifically between those two countries who are viewed as sort of like the hubs of the religion, it's based upon the recognition of certain religious or historic religious leaders in the discussion. And it takes on, you know, it has various dimensions to it, and it has various sort of like influences on it. But just so that you know, there are literally two sides, and these two particular sides, which are Sunni and Shiite, they've got their differences in terms of how specifically the religion needs to advance. What Rushdie obviously did was something completely different from these two sides. And what Rushdie also obviously implied in his work of fiction was something that, I mean, even as a Christian, you would could immediately identify, okay, but there's a lot of these magical elements portrayed within the book itself, which technically makes it a little bit weird. I mean, in some cases, for example, what was the play that some people love from Shakespeare? The one that actually annoys me the most, because it's a play that it uses not even fictional. It has an element of magical elements to it, and we all know that in an African context, the magical elements are sometimes perceived as a negative and viewed as a negative. Primarily because in terms of how we view suspected acts of witchcraft. But the discussion from that obviously being that if you ever read Midsummer Night's, Midsummer Night, that there's a lot of characters and elements in there that are just too peculiar. However, if you ever did read one of Shakespeare's other plays, more famous ones, like Macbeth is its name, which is based upon treachery, deceit, insanity, anxiety, and obviously the overall greed template that the character Macbeth and his wife endures on, or, decides to go on. The discussion is obviously one based upon something that you can see in real life and you can just visualize happening even in a modern day context. And even in the kind of storytelling that is being depicted. However, if you have the opportunity of reading this book, The Satanic Verses, written by Salman Rushdie, it is a conversation that you've got to approach with not with a Christian perspective. Unfortunately, you have to be open-minded, and open-minded is a broad statement and a broad label. You'll have to be open-minded, and you'll have to read the work for what it is, and then, secondly, make up your particular mind in terms of how the story was put together. Yes, it starts off on a wonderful note. Two particular immigrants from India, who have different kinds of jobs, unfortunately finding themselves in this unfortunate circumstance of a plane hijacking. And yes, the 80s and the 70s was a place of geopolitical turmoil, geopolitical turbulence. There was a lot of acts of plane hijackings. Anyone who has heard of the Lockerbie bombing, which has been proven to be the fault of Gaddafi, unfortunately, just to target one guy who was on the airplane. I can't believe that Gaddafi did this. Just to kill one guy, he blows up a plane with 200 other people on the plane. Just because the same guy was on the plane, the guy that they were targeting. Which are acts of recklessness. Which are acts clearly, in many cases, viewed in the Western world as acts of aggression. If you attack the airlines of Western countries, they are viewed as acts of aggression. Now, the important thing also to take away from the particular scenario, obviously, regarding the fatwa issuance, Rushdie's particular freedom of expression, has been how do you look at this talking point. Now, I've highlighted to you some of the key elements, obviously, that come out from the book itself, or that come from the book, but there were early reactions that happened when the book came out. Now, even before the book was printed, The publisher had received warnings from the publisher's editorial consultant that the book might be controversial. Later on, Rushdie would also reflect upon the time that the book was about to be published. Speaking to an interviewer at one stage, he said, "I expected a few mullahs would have been offended." If you don't know what a mullah is like a religious, local religious leader, almost like a pastor. And he cited, "They would call me names and then I would defend myself in public. I honestly never expected anything like this." End of quote. Now, the book was also then published by the printing house or the publishing house, Viking Penguin, which was a American division of Penguin Random House, on 26 September 1988 in the UK, and it came out on 22 February 1989 in the United States. And upon its publication, the book garnered considerable critical acclaim in the UK. On 8 November of 1988, the work received the Whitbread Award for Novel of the Year. Now, the Whitbread Award is a annual literary award recognizing English language books by writers based in the UK and Ireland. And he even received a £20,000 reward specifically for this achievement. According to one observer, almost all the British book reviewers were unaware of the book's connection to Islam. That's actually very convenient, because Rushdie had used the name Mahmud instead of Muhammad for his chapter on Islam in the book. Then came the Muslim response and also the book bannings. Now, after the book was published in the UK in 1988, there were protests by Muslims that predominantly took place in India and the United Kingdom. And when the book was published in February of 1989 in the US, it received renewed attention, and also worldwide protests began to take a more violent form. Now, in Islamic communities, the novel became instantly controversial because of what some Muslims considered blasphemous references. Rushdie was accused of misusing freedom of speech, and by October of 1988, letters and phone calls had arrived at Viking Penguin from Muslims around the world, specifically angry with the book and demanding that it be withdrawn. Now, before the end of that month of October 1988, the import of the book was banned in India, although possession of the book was not a criminal offense. In November of 1988, it was also banned in Bangladesh, Sudan, and even in South Africa. By December of 1988, it was also banned in Sri Lanka. And in March of 1989, it was then banned in Malaysia, and followed up by a ban in Brunei in the same year. I just want to make sure if Brunei still exists. In Britain, on 2 December of 1988, 7,000 Muslims in the town of Bolton staged the first ever demonstration against the book. After the Friday prayers, a certain section of the congregation marched from the Diobandi that was run by a different particular gentleman to the town center and then burned the book, or a copy of the book. Now, the organizers also claimed that it was a peaceful protest and highlighted that they only burned the book to try and attract public attention. The city of Bradford gained international attention on January of 1989 when some of its community members organized a public book burning session of the book itself, evoking, as the journalist Robert Winder recalled, images of medieval intolerance. Yeah. Pretty strong worded, but yeah. In February of that year as well, when the United States edition was published, a new round of reviews and criticism also occurred, because by March of 1989, it saw the book being banned in Kenya, Thailand, Tanzania, Indonesia, and Singapore. And the last nation to book the ban was Venezuela in June of 1989. On 12 February 1989, a 10,000 strong protest against Rushdie and the book took place in Islamabad, Pakistan, and six protesters were killed in an attack on the American Cultural Center, and an American Express office was ransacked in Pakistan. Then came the attacks. In the United States, the FBI was notified of 78 threats of bookstores in early March of 1989, thought to be a small proportion of the total number of threats. The bookstore chain, B. Dalton, for instance, received 30 threats in less than 3 hours. Bombings of bookstores included two in Berkeley, California. In New York City, the office of the community newspaper, the Riverdale Press, was all but destroyed by firebombs following the publication of an editorial defending the right to read the novel and criticizing the bookstores that pulled it from the shelves. But the UK was the country where violence against bookstores occurred most often and persisted the longest. Two large bookstores in Charing Cross Road in London, which was Collett's and Dillon's, were bombed on 9 April. In May of that same year, 1989, explosions went off in the town of High Wycombe and again in London on King's Road. Other bombings included one at a large London department store, Liberty's, that was the store's name, in connection with the Penguin bookshop that was inside the store, and at the Penguin store in York, in the city of York as well. And unexploded devices were also found at Penguin stores in Guildford, Nottingham, and in Peterborough. Now, in the US, it was unavailable in about one third of bookstores, and in many others that carried the book, it was kept under the counter. So it wasn't promoted in the shop window. It wasn't promoted positioned anywhere on a shelf. It wasn't kept anywhere. You literally had to ask over the counter for the shop attendant if you could buy a copy and whether or not they distributed a copy. So that meant that distribution was still active. So when the fatwa came about in 1989, on 14 February, very lovely, obviously, Valentine's reference, you can either be in love or you could probably lose your life. That is my joke. Sorry, guys. So on 14 February of 1989, obviously, the Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, the supreme leader of Iran at the time and one of the most prominent Shia Muslim leaders, issued the fatwa calling for the death of Rushdie and his publishers, which also included his publishers, remember. Now, this created a major international incident that persisted for many years. It was specifically broadcasted on Iranian radio, and the judgment actually reads, and I'm actually sitting with the text in front of me. We are from Allah, and to Allah we shall return. I am informing all brave Muslims of the world that the author of the book, a text written, edited, and published against Islam, the Prophet of Islam, and the Quran, along with all the editors and publishers aware of its contents, are condemned to death. I call on all of the valiant Muslims, wherever they may be in the world, to attack them. You can use the word kill them without delay, so that no one will dare insult the sacred beliefs of Muslims henceforth, and whoever is killed in the cause will be a martyr, Allah willing. Meanwhile, if someone has access to the author of the book but is incapable of carrying out the execution, he should inform the people so that Rushdie is punished for his actions. End of quote. Written by Ruhollah al-Musavi al-Khomeini. Now, Khomeini did not give a legal reasoning for the judgment. You can obviously guess why, because this is a religious leader. In many cases, they don't respect legal reasoning. But it is thought to be based on the 9th chapter of the Quran, called Al-Tawbah, verse 61, where it states, some of them hurt the Prophet by saying, he is all ears, and say, it is better for you that he listens to you, he believes in God and trusts the believers, he is a mercy for those among you who believe. Now, this particular explanation was not obviously given, and how that chapter specifically could support such a particular judgment. And over the course of the next few days after the announcement by the Iranians, Iranian officials offered a bounty of $6 million for the death of Rushdie, who was thus forced to live under police protection for the next 9 years. And so on 7 March of 1989, the UK and Iran broke diplomatic relations over the Rushdie controversy. Now, there's obviously something that Salman Rushdie did. He did apologize. Rushdie's apology for the book and for its printing and for its distribution obviously, after the 14 February announcement by the Iranians, on 18 February, the Iranian president, Ali Khamenei, who would later that year succeed Khomeini, Khamenei and Khomeini, just so you guys know, it's two different guys. He succeeded Khomeini as the supreme leader, suggested that if Rushdie apologizes and disowns the book, people may forgive him. And following this, Rushdie did issue a carefully worded statement saying, "I recognize that Muslims in many parts of the world are genuinely distressed by the publication of my novel. I profoundly regret the distress. The publication has occasioned to the sincere followers of Islam. Living as we do in a world of many faiths, this experience has served to remind us that we must all be conscious of the sensibilities of others." Now, it is not a clear apology. It is also just an explanation. And this was relayed even to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Tehran, the Iranian Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Tehran, via official channels, supposedly, before being released to the press. And immediately, as is, you know, anticipated, there was a rejection of this explanation, because it's not an apology. It is not an apology. I'm sorry, it is not an apology that was issued by Rushdie, which also highlighted a little bit of his ego as well. So it was rejected the next day on the 19th of February 1989 by Khomeini's office, who replied, "The imperialist foreign media falsely alleged that the officials of the Islamic Republic have said the sentence of death on the author of the book will be retracted if he repents. Imam Khomeini has said this is denied 100%. Even if Salman Rushdie repents and becomes the most pious man of all time, it is incumbent on every Muslim to employ everything he has got, his life and wealth, to send him to hell." End of quote. So as you can obviously see, the politics were at play. Well, Rushdie did not apologize. I'll have to be honest in that regard. I cannot defend him after that particular statement, even if it is his freedom of expression. However, as someone that expresses themselves through their work, it should obviously based upon, if it's a work of fiction, it becomes artistic or it becomes creative. But if it's something like in the line of work that I am in, you stay on the facts. You stay on the facts. Nothing more, nothing less. Straightforward stuff. It's a scientific process, and everyone can duplicate it. However, there was further drama. Khomeini also added, specifically after the rejection of the supposed apology, which I still cannot see as an apology, Khomeini added, "If a non-Muslim becomes aware of Rushdie's whereabouts and has the ability to execute him quicker than a Muslim, it is incumbent on the Muslims to pay a reward or a fee in return for said action." So, in a 2007 article, a journalist by the name of Anthony McRoy theorized that Khomeini refused the apology on the basis of an interpretation of the Islamic law posited by Al-Shafi'i, a 9th century jurist who is in his Risala, it's a specific kind of a book, that ruled that an apostate is also killed unless he repents. Whoever abuses the messenger of God is to be executed or harmed, and his repentance is not accepted. So, there was support for the fatwa, or the issuance of the fatwa. In Britain, the Union of Islamic Students Associations in Europe, which is the largest collective of Islamic students in Europe, issued a statement offering to do harm on behalf of Khomeini. Despite incitement to murder being illegal in the United Kingdom, one London property developer also told reporters, start of quote, "If I see him, I will do harm to him straight away. Take my name and address. One day, I will do harm to him." End of quote. So there was a lot of drama, obviously, in threat to Salman Rushdie's particular life. Despite supporting the fatwa, some other leaders claimed that the British Muslims were not allowed to carry out the fatwa themselves in order to avoid violating the law of the land in which they are a minority. and that only outside Muslims had an obligation to carry out the fatwa. Proponents of this particular view included the Muslim parliament and its leader, Kalim Siddiqui, who later on said he believed he may have been partially responsible for getting Khomeini to issue the fatwa. And after Siddiqui's death in 1996, however, his successor, Khayasuddin Siddiqui, renewed support for the fatwa. His support for the fatwa also continued, even after the president of Iran said his government would not pursue, though also not withdraw, the fatwa, and reiterated his support in 2000 as well. Meanwhile, in the United States, the director of the Near East Studies Center at UCLA, George Sabah, told an interviewer that Khomeini was completely within his rights to call for Rushdie's demise, in a way. And in May of 1989, in Beirut, Lebanon, a British citizen, Jackie Mann, was abducted in response to Iran's fatwa against Salman Rushdie for the publication of the book, and more specifically, for his refuge and protection in the United Kingdom. He joined several Westerners who were held hostage there as well, and 2 months earlier, a photograph of three teachers that were held hostage was released by the Islamic Jihad for the Liberation of Palestine. Okay, so the Palestinians also did not do themselves any particular favors in this action, but anyway, with the message that it would take revenge against all institutions and organizations that insulted in one way or another members of the Prophet Muhammad's family. It is an interesting discussion. Freedom of expression is a tricky thing. It's also a tricky thing specifically in terms of the modernization of the world. Obviously, some parts of the world are advancing and trying to achieve the economic fortunes of the future or even of the current, while you have some parts of the world still stuck potentially somewhere in the 1500s. We obviously have a particular unique picture that is described here in front of us, primarily one based upon how does expression continue going ahead. Now, on that particular note, dear listeners, we'll be stepping into a short musical break, which will take us up to the top of the hour at 7 a.m. Now, after that, we'll be saying our goodbyes, specifically from my side. However, stay tuned. We'll be back right after this.
I love you.
Show me. Something got me started. You know that I will love you. Lately since we parted, truly know that I need you. I give it all up for 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 you.
Yes,
I give it all up for you.
Yes,
I give it all up for you.
Yes,
I give it all up for you.
Yes, I would.
Broken-hearted, guilty of what I did to you. Lately since we parted, I truly know that I need you. Yes, I do, because I give it all up for you. 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 I give it all up for you.
Yes,
I give it all up for you.
Yes,
I give it all up for you.
Yes,
I give it all up for you.
Yes, I would.
Come on.
I really love you.
And as we come back there from the sounds primarily of, what was their name? Simply Red. I could have forget Simply Red's name. But yeah, as we come back specifically from that particular aspect, and I do see we've got a caller on the line. Let me quickly get that in. Eagle FM, good morning.
Dwight.
Morning, Uncle Bona. How are you doing?
Fine, thank you. Morning.
Yep, yep.
How are things, man?
No, I'm okay, Uncle Bona. I'm okay, you know. Just an interesting talking point.
You have read a lot of literature book.
There's
a literature book that I used to see.
Well, Uncle Bona, I'm still reading more because I you know, there's still so much storytelling that I like. But yeah, you can continue, Uncle Bona, where you left off. Uncle Bona?
Okay.
Uncle Bona, hello.
Yes.
Do you hear me?
Hello.
Yes. You cut out for a while.
Oh, what I was saying is that I like the, you know, that English literature, that analytical skill that I actually deprived.
Uncle Bona, hello. Sorry, Uncle Bona. You can still call back because you're cutting out. Uncle Bona, do you hear me?
I am hearing you.
Oh, yeah. You keep cutting out, Uncle Bona. Why are you walking about?
No, I'm just standing, stand still.
Oh.
Yeah, what I was saying is that we have learned a lot of lessons there.
Mm.
How to frame our language, how we...
Uncle Bona? Hello? Uncle Bona? All right. You can still call through Uncle Bona.
So let me call maybe next time, because it's because of the mountainous place.
Oh. So you are... I knew it, Uncle Bona. I knew it. Oh, yeah.
Okay, nevertheless, we can talk next time.
All right, Uncle Bona. Thanks for calling.
I remember this point. Okay.
Yep. And on that particular note, dear listeners, it does bring us up to the end. For now, obviously, the caller's contribution couldn't go through because of the persistent weak signal. But still, the technology should not stop us from engaging and having discourse. On that note as well from my side, stay tuned for the next programming to come after the break. We'll take a short musical break and you can still catch me through the course of the week on the home run. Alternatively, there's also the particular, programming to follow on right after the break. On that note, enjoy the rest of your Sunday morning in our company. And this has been my Sunday morning take.